and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a controversial new law in Israel that would help shield Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from corruption charges has passed an initial vote. Are Netanyahu's days as Prime Minister numbered? Next, the right-wing billionaire Koch brothers are major players in the $2.8 billion takeover of big-name publications like Time and Fortune magazines. The concentration of the media in the hands of a tiny group of elites continues. Then, despite a report by the Defense Manpower Data Center, the Pentagon is stubbornly denying what has become obvious. There are thousands more U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq than previously claimed. And then dozens of local police departments have been enlisted in the Trump administration's war on immigrants under a program to deputize police to work for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. And finally, tensions between the United States and Russia are heating up further as the Pentagon complains of an unsafe intercept of a U.S. spy plane operating near Russian borders. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, a controversial new law in Israel that would help shield Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from corruption charges has passed an initial vote. Are Netanyahu's days as Prime Minister numbered? We are joined from Amman, Jordan by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Daoud, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what exactly does this mean? You know, it seems to us in the United States that with as many problems as Israel has, when it does have corrupt politicians, they're brought to justice. In this case, it looks like a corrupt politician will not be brought to justice. What's happening over there?
The Israeli public is moving to the far right, and it seems that, like in America, tribalism trumps everything else, and tribalism in Israel is blinding people from basic values and ethics, and they're trying to protect their leader, irrespective of history and culture. I'm not sure this law is going to pass, and I'm not sure it will be allowed to pass by the Israeli High Court, but this law does not stop the investigation, just puts some obstacles in the way of the investigation.
And what's Netanyahu being investigated for? Let's help the audience understand why this is a big deal.
There are a number of cases in which he's investigated for. He's investigated for the fact that he has received all kinds of, he and his family, all kinds of gifts from American Jewish and other philanthropes in return for different areas of support that he's given them and intervention with the U.S. government and so on. He's also accused of colluding with the famous newspaper, a leading newspaper, on charges of trying to cut down or close down a competing newspaper. And thirdly, he's accused also of some kind of corruption in terms of a German submarine that Israel is buying from Germany.
Daoud, RT reported today that the bill would curb the powers of police to consult with the federal attorney over pressing charges in individual cases. That sounds crazy. It sounds like it would then essentially stop the police from even interviewing anybody if they're not allowed to bring the case to a federal attorney for consultation.
No, I'm not sure that RT's description is correct. I think the issue here is, I mean, there is obviously an attempt to curtail the work of the investigators, but it doesn't stop them. It makes it much more difficult. And the claim here is that a sitting prime minister or head of state should not be dragged to different investigations while he is in power, the kind of idea of an impeachment rather than a kind of indictment. So that's the kind of background to this issue. But as you said, it smells so fishy because the people who are pushing for this are his loyal supporters in the Likud party who are trying to protect him.
Now, we know that the governing coalition is a coalition of many, many parties. So tell us what this bill would face in terms of opposition in the Knesset. What are the real chances of it passing into law?
Well, the coalition supports Netanyahu. So in their eye, if this is part of staying in government, you know, the problem with opposing this bill or opposing a bill that the government wants or the leadership wants is that there would be a call for new elections. I mean, there's a lot of discussion now that there might be new elections. And new elections is a kind of a risky issue because those who are in power today might find themselves out of the Knesset if there's new elections. Already, the Likud is seen to lose some seats and new parties are seen to gain seats. So it's a question of whether they will allow for new elections or kind of bite the bullet and accept these new laws. So it's not clear what will happen.
So let's go to the bigger picture here, since it's unclear whether this bill will in fact prevent, well, first, whether it'll pass the Knesset, and secondly, whether it will really inhibit the ongoing multiple investigations of Netanyahu for corruption. Tomorrow is November 29th. That's the day in 1947, 70 years ago tomorrow, that the partition of Israel took place. Later, the United Nations, when the relationship of forces changed inside the General Assembly, maybe 30 years later, November 29th became proclaimed a day of international solidarity with the Palestinian people. Given the fact that you have different political parties vying for power and using both the elections and also the courts to sort of fight it out within Israel proper, does any of that internal internecine struggle in Israel have a positive or negative impact on the Palestinians? Or is that such a sort of a contained drama that it doesn't really impact the people living in the West Bank or Gaza or the Arab Palestinian population within Israel proper?
Well, whatever happens in Israel does impact Palestinians in the West Bank and does have affect Palestinians who are members or who are citizens of Israel. The problem is that coalition governments in Israel are usually a mix of being always on the verge of being, dissolved, but always somehow finding a way to stay afloat because everybody's afraid of new elections. So the problem here is that the supporters of Netanyahu or the settlers and the right-wing groups really believe strongly that he is the best person in their camp, and they are trying very hard to keep him in position, and they don't care about the corruption issues unless they, it's such a hot issue that they cannot avoid. Even now, they're saying, even if he's indicted, that he should stay in power. And if he doesn't resign because of being indicted, he can stay in power for many years until the indictment brings about a kind of a final result in the court. So his supporters are very adamant in their loyalty to him, and they don't care about the peace process, and in fact they want him to stay so that the peace process will not move and the two-state solution or any other kind of solution will not become the force of power in the international community to force Israel to make some concessions.
Brian, I think Dawood is exactly correct. There have been several recent public opinion polls released in Israel. And those polls say that Netanyahu is still by far the most important politician in Israel and the most popular. Indeed, even with this indictment hanging over him, the polls say that Netanyahu's Likud party, the Conservative Party, would pick up as many as 24 new Knesset seats. So this notion that even if he is indicted, a trial or an actual case could be sort of staved off for years, I think is probably true. I think whether we like it or not, we're probably stuck with Netanyahu as the Prime Minister of Israel.
Indeed. And Dawood made the point, of course, that in the United States system of governance, a sitting president can't be, or except under the most exceptional circumstances, can't be criminally indicted. And thus, the real issue is about impeachment. So if a president commits high crimes or misdemeanors, they're impeached. And if they're impeached, they lose their seat. They lose office. They don't go to jail. Netanyahu supporters are saying, well, you shouldn't have a chief executive of the state being subject to criminal inquiry. And that's the reason this bill is introduced.
One of the things I want to point out, and in fact, Benny Begin, the son of Mr. Begin, the former prime minister, was removed from a subcommittee because he is saying, fine, this is a good issue, a good law, but don't make it retroactive. Make it for the future, prime ministers. But you cannot pass a law now that tries to exonerate existing or sitting prime ministers. Like any other law, you don't make laws that go backwards and retroactively. And as a result of that complaint, they basically removed him from his committee membership. So the question here is not whether this is an appropriate law in a kind of a neutral situation. The question is, this law is being made specifically and only for Mr. Netanyahu to get him out of trouble.
And thus we know it in the media, at least, as the Netanyahu bill. That's amazing, really, John. I mean, we have a bill passing through the Knesset by Netanyahu supporters that are just designed to shield Netanyahu.
Yeah, this bill benefits only one person, and that is Benjamin Netanyahu.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutab. He is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. After a very short break, you'll be listening to us once again here at Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The right-wing billionaire Koch brothers are major players in the $2.8 billion takeover of big-name publications like Time Magazine and Fortune Magazine. The concentration of the media in the hands of a tiny group of elites continues. We are joined from Philadelphia by Danielle Corcione. Danielle is a freelance journalist whose writings have appeared in Vice and Salon. You can find Danielle's work at daniellecorcione.com. Welcome, Danielle. Danielle, this is not a surprise, not shocking, but perhaps a fairly big deal because Time Magazine, like almost all of the magazines, are sort of losing ventures commercially. The print media is going down, down, down. Why did the Koch brothers put their money into a magazine that's going down commercially?
So this deal has kind of been going on for a while. Reuters originally reported that there were talks of Meredith purchasing Time Inc. back in 2013. And then the rise of they're just watching to see how the numbers did. But it's just another example of owning an entire media conglomerate and just buying it out so that the owners have a little bit more political leverage and to push their ideas onto like mainstream newsstands and its digital publications.
Danielle, I keep telling myself that the Koch brothers are not as bad as most of us think they are, that they are libertarians and that they're not doctrinaire right-wing activists. Billionaire right-wing activists. Am I being silly? Should I be worried about this?
So you don't necessarily have to be a right-wing activist and very really into that in order to cause damage and for anyone to be alarmed, because I think this trend is indicative of something larger that's going on. So we have Sinclair Broadcast Group that was owned by Smith that is kind of taking over local broadcast stations, pushing right-wing viewpoints into their coverage. We have Robert Murdoch, who did this with 21st Century Fox. He took over the Wall Street Journal in 2007. There is a Media Matters story by Matt Gaetz that was published yesterday that kind of talks about, you know, when the time employees got the announcement that it was bought out, the employee doesn't need to worry. However, people can look about what other billionaires have done once they have purchased media outlets just from 10 years ago and see what's going on. We also have the Las Vegas Review that was acquired by Sheldon Adelson. He was a casino mogul. And you could see that in the documentary Nobody Speaks, Trials of the Free Press, which originally focused on Gawker and Hulk Hogan, which was backed by Peter Thiel of PayPal and pretty much brought down Gawker. But the second half of the film talked about how the Las Vegas Review was pretty much bought out. And so many of the staff that were working there decided to give up their entire careers of journalism because they didn't believe in the ideals that the new owner was pushing.
You know, that's really the bottom line, Brian, too. And it makes me even more worried for independent broadcast voices or independent print journalism voices. Already you have outlets like the Washington Post, which is owned by another billionaire, Jeff Bezos, that publish articles saying that so many of the alternative news is Russian propaganda with no evidence, no proof of any kind.
You didn't get your message from Putin today? You know,
I didn't get my marching orders from Putin this morning, but I will say that of the four or five different outlets that I've written for, every last one of them has been accused by the Washington Post of being a Russian stooge, yeah, for lack of a better word. Now, here we have the likes of Time Magazine, for example, and Fortune Magazine, both of which I happen to read, falling under the rubric of yet another billionaire or group of billionaires. It's a dark day for journalism in the United States.
And I think the real goal here of the Koch brothers is to create consciousness. They have a political agenda. They're trying to create consciousness. And over time, especially with media consolidation and the repeated redundant messaging of certain things. In other words, like ExxonMobil researchers knew that climate change was real, but then it wasn't ExxonMobil then, it hadn't been consolidated yet. Exxon, paid people to create seminars and educational programs and write papers, all of which was to deny that which Exxon knew to be true, which was that the environment was being impacted by human activity and especially the release of carbons and most notably oil production. So they want to change consciousness. This is from Mary Botari, Center for Media and Democracy, talking about what the Koch brothers and these other right-wing media forces are trying to do with their control over more and more of the media. The only way they can convince the public not to worry their heads about climate change and to forget about regulating the fossil fuel industry is to create their own media megaphone. In other words, if Exxon or ExxonMobil now says, don't believe in climate change, everybody will say, well, of course they're saying that. They're an oil company. They want to convince us that they're benign, that the production of oil or the harvesting of oil is benign. So nobody would believe that. But you need like a credible brand like Time Magazine, for instance. And I would say the same is true with Bezos and Washington Post, a name brand that has credibility in order to convince the public. So Danielle, the Koch brothers say they're not going to have a seat on the board of Time Magazine. They're not going to be directly influencing its editorial positions. I mean, but why else would they actually purchase it?
Yeah, I think a lot of this also has to do with the ruling class's influence on media that's perceived as distant, because journalists are expected to adhere to this myth of objectivity. How can we look at a story objectively and report on it? Meanwhile, the people who own these media publications, that own these giant corporations, essentially, like, they are donating to specific campaigns. We relatively transparent about what they're doing. So the people in power have the voice to support whatever candidates, to support whatever campaign that they can, whether it's Trump, whether it's Hillary, whether it's whoever. But the worker does not have a voice. The worker does not have a voice to share their political opinions without being reprimanded.
It's like the old cliche. You have freedom of press if you have enough money to buy the press. I mean, it really,
that's what it's come down to.
And now we have a situation where Google and Facebook, under the pressure, say, of the Congress, they said last week, the Eric Schmidt of the of Google's CEO said, we're going to derank and delist RT and Sputnik, our station, for instance, because they came under pressure from the government to, you know, show that they were doing their part to be part of the American team against Russian propaganda. And Bezos, let's go back. Now, the Washington Post is supporting the Democrats, but Bezos, Amazon, he owns Amazon, one of the three richest people in the country. He also has a huge contract with the CIA. I mean, in the CIA.
And now two contracts.
So it's not really just about, as Danielle's saying, Democrats and Republicans, even though the Koch brothers are decidedly in the camp of the Republicans. I mean, the fundamental question is whether you can have democracy if people are being spoon-fed information by one group of political elites or another group of political elites. And part of this now is demonizing alternative media. So people think, oh, if it doesn't come from Time or Washington Post or
right,
then, you know, it might be fake news. I mean, that's part right. of what's happening. Go ahead, Danielle. We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because as these media conglomerates gain more power and there's very limited, there's limited staff working when, you know, Condé Nast just laid off, I think, about 200 workers. And we see that as these corporations get bigger and bigger, there's less people power driving it. There's more emphasis on branded content, which is not catered to actual news consumers. It's catered to the brands that they want to push. And sponsored content is essentially when a company pays a publication to write an advertorial. So we see the rise of that once that happens. And we have fewer and fewer media outlets because as these get bigger and bigger, there's less reliance on independent news, less people who want to believe that independent news is actually credible.
And then we have the enormous power wielded by billionaires just generally. Then you had Ricketts shutting down Gothamist and DCist
right.
because
with the snap of a finger,
because independent reporters wanted to unionize, wanted workers' rights. I mean, it's really something. Anyway, we are completely out of time. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Danielle Corcione. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very, very short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Despite a report by the Defense Manpower Data Center, the Pentagon is stubbornly denying what has become obvious. There are thousands more U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq than previously claimed. We are joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma by Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's a professor of history at the University of Tulsa and the author of Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
I mean, you would think that the people of the United States, it's their tax dollars and the government that speaks in its name and is often faraway lands carrying out military operations, that they should be told the truth, what the numbers are. I mean, why is this even an issue where officially, I think, John Kiriakou, the government, the Pentagon was saying there were 503 troops, a very
That's
precise
right.
number in Syria. But perhaps there are thousands. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Well, and there are also thousands of private military contractors. That's a very kind of tricky way that they can also, you know, deceive the public by making like there's, you know, light footprint when there's actually a pretty heavy American footprint in these places and many other lands around the world because they employ so many private military contractors who perform functions the military used to perform.
You know, John, when the United States went to war in World War II, there was no hiding the number of troops.
Absolutely not.
I mean, what this kind of started during Vietnam when there were advisors, not troops, because actually the U.S. government was defensive about the mission. They didn't really want to tell the people about the mission. They didn't want to tell them about casualties. The first Vietnam War casualties, I think in 1961, of some of the advisors were like small news because, in fact, these are kind of concealed operations.
That's
kind
right.
of overt, kind of covert.
And to make matters worse, we've transitioned to a point where we conceal these numbers from Congress as well. And shame on Congress, because they're supposed to be the overseers. They're supposed to make sure that the honest people are kept honest and that the American people are kept informed.
Yeah, and there was a reason, Jeremy, that in the U.S. Constitution, the power to declare war was only with Congress, even though that, you know, for the last 75 years, that doesn't exist. Go ahead.
Well, I think it comes down to the fact that the United States was founded as a republic and supposed to function as a republic, but evolved as an empire. And a lot of the public is uneasy with that fact. So they have to conceal, you know, the government and the executive branch has to conceal a lot of what it's doing, which is imperial. I mean, the United States has, the New York Times reported that the United States has soldiers in 172 different nations. That's not imperial. I mean, that's far greater than the Roman or British Empire. So, but we're supposed to be a republic. So they have to couch what they're doing in, you know, certain lingo and hide the number of soldiers and conceal a lot of what they're actually doing before the public, which, yeah, should be more outraged.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking with Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's a professor of history at the University of Tulsa. He's also an author of the book Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century. Some of the right-wing conservatives call America a welfare state. I think it's more appropriate to call it a warfare state. Not only is it constantly at war, it has 800 military installations and bases in about 140 countries. And now, according to the Defense Manpower Data Center, according to these numbers, listen to these numbers, almost 30,000 U.S. service members are deployed in three countries. That would include Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The report, which provides data current as of September 30th, states there are 8,892 personnel in Iraq, 15,298 in Afghanistan, and 1,720 in Syria. And John, Jeremy is right. The use of private contractors, some might call them mercenaries, but they're certainly there. They carry guns.
Right.
They're part of the operation.
They're highly trained.
If the Iraq war numbers were any sort of any indication, this number might actually be almost doubled.
Well, and in fact, these numbers are far higher than what we saw during the Obama administration. And it was candidate Donald Trump who promised to pull us out of these foreign entanglements. In fact, he's mired us more deeply into wars that we just seemingly can't get out of.
And Trump also said, Jeremy, I'm going to give my generals, they're his generals now, everything's his property. But he said, I'm going to give my generals the sort of blank check. They can do whatever they want. So what apparently my generals have been doing is loading up the numbers of official troops and probably private contractors in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, secretly. That's what it seems like.
I mean, the question people have to ask is to what end? I mean, what are these troops actually accomplishing for anybody? I mean, Afghanistan has gone on for 16 years now. It's just a complete quagmire. I mean, the Taliban is stronger than they ever were. So the public has to be asking, what are they achieving? Very little,
Well, Donald Trump said he told them to start winning.
Yeah. And, you know, the truth is, and you ask candidate Donald Trump this, and he'll tell you the truth, that they're achieving nothing. I'm struck, Brian, by several what I think are hilarious tweets that Donald Trump sent out during the campaign. For example, in 2013, he said that Obama wanted to protect Al-Qaeda Islamists in Syria. Syria is not our problem, exclamation point. He later called Charles Krauthammer, who's legendary in the conservative movement in this country, dummy political pundit. Krauthammer constantly pressed the crazy war in Iraq. Many lives lost and trillions of dollars wasted. U.S. got nothing, in capital letters with exclamation points. And then again, 2 weeks later, again, speaking of Krauthammer, he said, Krauthammer has never apologized for being so totally wrong on Iraq. I called it right in every way. Make America great again, exclamation point. So this is exactly the opposite position that he's taken as president. He's actually gotten us deeper into these wars.
Yeah. I mean, 180 degree change. I mean, because the American people don't want to be in Iraq.
No,
they don't want to be in Afghanistan. They don't want to be in Syria. If you're running for office, that's a popular, that's smart. That's smart politics.
And imagine the money we could have had freed up for the best roads in the world, the best hospitals, the best airports, the best education, free medical care for everybody. And we decided to spend it on war instead.
It was only about $3 trillion, though, Jeremy, I think. And it was off budget, by the way.
Indeed,
it's not part of the Pentagon budget.
That's
so the
right.
Pentagon budget is in addition to those almost $3 trillion. Jeremy, what is a victory look like in Afghanistan? What does it even mean at this point, 16 years on?
Well, I think at this point, I think we've discussed this before. You know, there was an article in the New York Times that quoted Trump, and he was very enthusiastic about the economic prospects. He's pretty overt about it.
Oh, right, the minerals. He said, let's look for minerals in Afghanistan.
And take them.
I mean, there doesn't appear to be any. Perhaps you could look at the geography of Afghanistan and certain strategic advantages, but I think it's just a grab for the resources and a fear that the Chinese might move in there and grab some of those resources. And Trump's been pretty open about that and has the mindset of a businessman himself. So I think that's the only reason. But I don't think there can be a victory. I mean, I think Afghanistan has suffered from foreign invasions for centuries, and they're never going to allow a foreign country to operate unharmed. There's going to be inevitable and constant resistance so long as the United States is there, and the Taliban will keep getting stronger and stronger. So I don't think you can have any military solution at this point.
I think victory now means, John and Jeremy, that the Pentagon can keep getting billions and billions of dollars to keep this thing going. A victory also means not losing. It means the politicians, whether they be in civilian three-piece suits or in uniform, don't have to take responsibility for leaving. In other words, nobody wants to take responsibility for a withdrawal that looks like a defeat. So more and more people are going to die. More and more money is going to be spent so that no politician has to take responsibility for what might be a defeat.
Yeah, whatever happened to that old Vietnam era idea of just declaring victory and going home?
There's too much money. Now so many people are making money off the war.
Yeah, that's it right there.
It won't stop because so many people are invested in making money off it.
And I actually have to say, I think in Vietnam, they couldn't actually declare victory. I think
no.
I think everybody knew that was a big loss. And I think that's actually part of the issue right now is nobody wants to be Richard Nixon pulling out of any country. So people just keep fighting and dying sent by these politicians so that no one has to take responsibility.
And in the meantime, the Washington area has the most millionaires per capita of any place in America, thanks to
the warfare state,
permanent wartime economy.
All right, that's it. We've been talking with Jeremy Kuzmarov, professor of history at the University of Tulsa. Stay with us. You'll be listening to the next episode of Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Dozens of police departments have been enlisted in the Trump administration's war on immigrants under a greatly expanded program to expand further powers normally reserved for ICE to local law enforcement. We're joined from New York by Angie Kim. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. Angie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
We're happy to do it. And I have, as my first question for you, Angie, this just seems so outrageous where local police are going to be deputized and they can make arrests of immigrants, undocumented immigrants, whenever they feel like it. Has anybody actually challenged the constitutionality of such an act?
Absolutely. So there have been a lot of non-profit organization who have filed a lawsuit, you know, against the policy based on its unconstitutionality. So, for example, the Justice Department had found that the 287G program is a authority to commit large-scale patterns or practiced constitutional violation. So we had a situation where, an example, like Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio had used this authority under the program to do sweeps, which targeted a lot of Latinos, and it was found illegally racially profiled. But it, essentially, it's a very cruel and inhumane, and it's just an instrument to arrest mass number of people for deportation purposes.
One of the disturbing things in the reports that have come out today, and I'm thinking in particular of one from Reuters, says that many departments are clamoring to be a part of this federal program. What Joe Arpaio was promoting in Maricopa County, Arizona, is now becoming the norm, where we have departments that constantly claim they're understaffed and underfunded. Now, instead saying, well, we want to take on this additional responsibility and we want to sweep through neighborhoods and scoop up people who we may think might possibly could be undocumented, and then turn them over to the federal authorities. So, one of the ugly things about this whole situation, this whole scenario, is that it's making Joe Arpaio look like he's not the outlier here, that this is becoming the norm.
Absolutely. So the 287G program was originally used to deport criminals who were screened while under arrest. However, like in 2006, officers or sheriffs started screening for public for public violations or civil immigration law. So, what that essentially did was it sort of turned the program from a criminal based like force model to a task force model. And what that essentially just means that there are no preferences, and a lot of the people who are detained or arrested under the program have no criminal records or very minor violations.
Walter, isn't it true that this program was downsized during the Obama administration because the Obama administration found that local departments were targeting Latinos specifically, despite the fact that there are more undocumented Chinese nationals in the United States than there are Latinos?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that this has a clear racist character to it. The Obama administration, I mean, we should point out, did massively increase deportations overall. So, for sure.
Indeed.
For sure, they're not like the heroes in this story, but you make a good point for sure. To go back to this situation with Joe Arpaio, I mean, he defied a court injunction, and the injunction was issued on the basis of the clear discriminatory effect, racially discriminatory effect of the policies that his sheriff's department had implemented. Angie Kim, what do you think in the departments that are sort of, eager to join these? And I mean, there are certain departments that like do want to, even though others, especially in larger cities, might say like, well, no, we're not interested in this. Among the officers themselves, is there frequently, like racial prejudice beyond the sort of like structural prejudice that's built into a policy like this?
For sure. I think, one of the bases in the way that the officers are screening for an arrestee or folks to deport or under the program have largely been based on racial profiling. One of the efforts that I am very much involved, because I'm an undocumented immigrant of an East Asia descent, is that the mainstream narrative around who the immigrants are in the country and the demographics of it are complete false, right? It's the media and a lot of the Trump's narrative have been around, you know, racially profiling and identifying undocumented immigrants to be Mexicans or from Latinx communities. That is not true. But however, the offices have used, you know, race and as a tool of, you know, profiling people that they either suspect to be an undocumented immigrant or folks that have been arrested.
And you know, since I brought up the bigger cities' police departments, I mean, I don't want to let them off the hook either. You know, I'm looking at a Reuters news article here, and it quotes Ross, the head of the police department there. I spent a lot of time in Philadelphia, and the city politicians there, as in many large cities that are dominated by the Democratic Party, you know, like to proclaim themselves sanctuary cities. You know, Trump can do whatever he wants, but here in our city, you know, we have control. We can protect everybody. I mean, that's not really true, is it?
Unfortunately, not entirely. So the threats that the so-called sanctuary cities will feel is that if they don't comply with you know, certain programs like 287 or any other programs, they're under the threat of their funds being cut from the government. And the second is, I know that, you know, a little while ago, Governor Cuomo had issued an executive order to sort of, you know, implement a lot of these, you know, ambiguous sanctuary city policies. And one of them was that, you know, local enforcement will not cooperate and interact with ICE or federal agents. Now, you know, to say that that is the end and be all is just not enough, and it's not true. What we need is to have every single law enforcement officers, even in sanctuary cities, to be trained, to be educated in what it means to be a sanctuary city, how to protect undocumented immigrants, and the policies. I don't want to get too much into detail, but because I don't want to jeopardize anyone, but I unfortunately was recently arrested at a protest and did have an unfortunate interaction with a police officer where my, you know, citizenship or my status was questioned. And this is happening in sanctuary cities. So, you know, we need more than just executive orders. We need more than just words. We need to have these policies implemented and have law enforcement officers educated.
I want to add something to that too, Angie. This is not just a big city problem. You know, so many undocumented workers have actually been encouraged to move to small cities and towns across the country because there are so many jobs that Americans don't want to do, right? Americans don't want to work in, let's say, chicken processing plants, and that's why there are so many undocumented workers in a place like North Carolina or the Eastern Shore of Maryland. But it's also in these small towns and communities where some of the most vociferous anti-immigrant law enforcement leaders are located. I'm thinking of an example in this Reuters article of Bensalem, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Philadelphia. The director of public safety there, a man by the name of Fred Herron, said that any immigrant in the country illegally who commits a crime, even a misdemeanor like shoplifting or possession of a small amount of drugs, should be deported. And he said, and this is a quote, "If deporting you out of this country when you commit a crime is a tool at my disposal, you are darn right that I'm going to use it," unquote. What he doesn't say then is this immediately strikes fear into just about everybody who is not documented here. And when a crime is committed and Fred Herron needs witnesses to that crime, he's then going to ask why nobody has come forward, why all of the witnesses ran for cover and are hiding. And it's because they're afraid of being deported. I think we have about 30 seconds or so, Angie. How about your final thoughts?
Absolutely. And there's, you know, I'd also like to add that these small towns are very economically driven to partake in this program, because essentially the program, what it'll do is it will provide funding for local jurisdiction to hire officers and get trained. And also, I think the facilities in the local jurisdiction for housing undocumented immigrants are also a bonus. So you're right, absolutely. It's a dire situation.
Yep, things have to change. That is it. Angie Kim, that was Angie Kim joining us from New York. She is an immigrant rights advocate and community organizer with the Minh Quan Center for Community Action. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're speaking with Mark Sloboda, international security and affairs analyst. We're talking to Mark from Moscow. Mark is a U.S. military veteran, about the confrontation or near confrontation in the Black Sea between a Russian fighter, which the United States says made an unsafe interception of a U.S. Navy plane over the Black Sea. What does it signify? Is it routine? Is it something extraordinary? Is it something in between? We're going to find out from Mark Sloboda. Mark, what is this all about?
Okay, well, this is just the latest of a long string of incidents that in the past years since the U.S. and Western governments backed the putsch that overthrew the Ukrainian government and the subsequent civil war in Ukraine and the conflict there in 2014, there have been a long string, almost every month or every other month, of these type of intercepts. And this is as the U.S. and NATO adopt a more aggressive posture in all of the naval areas surrounding Russia. We're talking the Black Sea, where this incident and several previous incidents have taken place. We're talking the Baltic Sea. We're talking the Okhotsk Sea in the far east of Russia, north of Japan. We've also seen some other incidents. The U.S. has had several such incidents with China in the South China Sea as well. And this is as they adopt a more forward confrontational posture. And the almost every one of such incidents occurs is the U.S. is sending spy planes at an ever-increasing rate straight towards Russia or, in some cases, Chinese borders, often at high speed. An intercept of such aircraft is perfectly normal. When these intercepts occur at close range, the U.S. Quite often gets a little more uncomfortable, and they protest about this. When Russia, and we don't know for sure that this was an unsafe, it's kind of a he said, she said story, but we can consider that at least some of them probably are meant to be somewhat provocative to deter the increased number of such spy planes pushing right up on its borders. And we're talking, the U.S. is now calling these spy plane flights routine operations. This is routine for them for every month to be flying, their most advanced. This was a Poseidon 8A, one of the Navy's most advanced spy planes. It's a big lumbering thing. It's basically a 737. It's even made by Boeing, packed full of top reconnaissance equipment. But it is also most frequently kitted out as a submarine killer. It has the military capability to engage and destroy submarines. So on top of its spy plane capabilities, it certainly has actionable, military danger that requires such intercepts and do require, a degree of concern on part of Russia, where the U.S. is characterizing these increased spy plane flights, right up on its borders as routine.
Mark, how is this any different from what goes on every day, every couple of days with these interceptions? How is this different from the U.S. intercepting a Russian plane off the coast of Alaska, let's say, that we read about in the papers all the time?
Okay, well, for one thing, that actually doesn't happen all the time because Russia doesn't have the capability to send planes as frequently as close to U.S. borders as the U.S. does, because the U.S. has this long string of military bases all around the world, right? Some 800 to 1,000, depending on the way you count them, foreign military bases, where Russia has like 14. And almost all of those are, you know, in the countries immediately surrounding Russia. So one, it doesn't happen as frequently the other way around. On Russia, however, when such missions have been intercepted by Russia, Russia has frequently complained of the same, that the U.S., when Russia is coming close to U.S. borders, the U.S., it says, makes unprofessional, unsafe intercepts. Likewise, most likely to deter such missions from taking place. And there is a degree of danger involved. In 2001, a Chinese fighter intercepting a U.S. spy plane over the South China Sea, closing in on China's borders. At least the U.S. version of events is that the spy plane intercepted too close, and there was a collision which resulted in the destruction of the Chinese plane and the death of the pilot. And severe damage to the U.S. plane, and it ending up at least briefly in Chinese hands. So, you know, there is a danger of military confrontation. That caused some political feathers to be ruffled, and there was an increased state of tensions for several months with China when that happened. This is, you know, also that something is considered with the Russia. There's the possibility. The rules that the U.S. and the Soviet Union established for air intercepts, you know, dates back to 1972 and are really badly out of date with modern technology. For instance, things that aren't covered as clearly in these matters is drones. And Russia has complained that over the Black Sea, the U.S. has flown over 100 U.S. Global Hawk spy drones to within the 10 to 15 kilometers of the Crimean border just in the last year. And if a military confrontation occurred between the U.S. and Russia, God forbid, some kind of starting as a conventional confrontation, somewhere between the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea is probably one of the most likely places for such a scenario to happen.
Oh yeah, agreed completely. Brian, the press is treating this as a major event, but these things don't happen in a vacuum, right? A pilot doesn't just decide one day he's going to fly along the Russian border and just see what happens. This is a political decision that's made. What happened today was after intercepting this plane, after the Russian jet intercepted the American spy plane, The American plane changed directions and flew away. What was more interesting to me was a later statement by the British Defense Secretary saying that this was likely in response to what he called an extraordinary increase in Russian submarine activity. So it appears to be something of a tit for tat. And I wonder if a political decision hasn't been made at the White House and or at Downing Street to try to increase pressure on the Russians.
Well, yeah, let's toss that back to Mark. But I do want to make the point, and it's kind of interesting. I think it's important, actually, what Mark was saying, that while both sides do this, and even though Sarah Palin says that when she's in Alaska, she can look over and see Russia because it's that close, most of us in the mainland of the United States can't look over and see Russia. And nor do we feel Russian spy planes buzzing our borders. In other words, I think if Americans really felt maybe what the Russians are feeling, where even if it's routine in one sense, it's happening more frequently and it's really right along Russia's border, or if it had been right along America's border, and under this specific political climate, which is so souped up, so charged, so confrontational, we'd probably react a lot differently. Mark Sloboda, 2 minutes left. Let's go back to John Kiriakou's question in terms of the intensity of this event and the context for it.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me simply attest, I cannot see Sarah Palin's house.
You can't see it?
You've looked.
Have you been up on the roof?
Maybe she's got better eyesight than I do.
She was probably on the roof.
Anyway, I think the reports of U.S. I think what the U.K. was actually discussing there was increased Russian submarine activity in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean between Britain and the U.S., which, of course, is a much larger and much more international body of water. And that seems very likely. But NATO has vastly increased its naval footprint in the Black Sea in recent months, and has announced the intention to increase it further again, such that a U.S. military warship will always be in the Black Sea. And it must be said that, you know, the Russia treats the Black Sea like the United States views the Gulf of Mexico. And it views, you know, the U.S. Warships and spy planes and spy drones encroaching on its borders in the Black Sea, that close to it on the other side of the world from the U.S., the same way that the U.S. would start create media panics and politicians screaming from the roofs of the Congress building if Russia was doing the same in the Gulf of the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico or, you know, off the California coast. So I think the proximity and, you know, the range of these things on a global scale has to be taken into account. This isn't Russia encroaching on U.S. borders as part of what they now describe as normal spy plane missions. This is the U.S. encroaching repeatedly in what Russia, or, you know, whether you consider it right or not, considers their backyard pool.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international security and affairs analyst. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area between 4 and 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Oh,